Is Burlington between Montreal and Toronto? Maybe in some metric. Oh, okay. Well, then, if you keep going, then you end up in Burlington. Thanks. Thank you for the invitation to speak. Once again, the organizers gave me the title for my talk. I told a joke at CRM last year. I wish that they had written the full talk for me, too. They still haven't done that, but nevertheless, thank you for the invitation and the title. I'm going to be talking about computing Hilbert modular forms. So let me just tell you right away the theorem, since there's been enough notation already introduced on what Hilbert modular forms are. Okay, so there's an algorithm. The theorem is the existence of an algorithm. This algorithm is due in various pieces to Lucina Dembélé, Steve Donnelly, Matthew Greenberg, and myself. And it goes as follows. So there exists an algorithm, which I have to specify for you the input and the output. So the input is a totally real field F, a weight K. For me, the weight needs to be integers, all at least two of the same parity, but that's just a vector of integers fitting that description, indexed by the number, by the degree, I guess, or the real places. And finally, a non-zero ideal of the ring of integers. And the output is the space Sk of n of Hilbert cusp forms of weight k and level n over f as a Hecke module. Okay, so what does that really mean in terms of bits? Computer doesn't understand all those things. You have to really reduce everything to zeros and ones. So what this computer would algorithm would really be doing, so there's an explicit finite procedure which takes as input the field F, the weight K, and the ideal N encoded in bits. So I say in the usual way, but the usual way is as follows. The number field F is specified by a minimal polynomial of a primitive element. But itself is specified by the coefficients of that polynomial, which themselves are rational numbers, which are quotients of integers, which are represented in usual binary expansion. Okay, so that's a sort of level of detail. So how would you, so you can imagine how you would input the weight. That's just a vector of integers. Okay, the ideal n, well, now you have to specify it by a set of generators. That set of generators probably needs to come from the ring of integers. And for those, you would need to specify the, say, a basis of the ring of integers given by powers of that primitive element that you specified by the polynomial. Okay, so not that many bits required to specify this as an algorithm. Okay, what's the output? Well, the output is this thing, the Hecke module. So as we all know, you can diagonalize via the Hecke operator, so it's enough to produce for you the eigenvalues, if you like to think about it that way. I do. So the output is a finite set of sequences. So these sequences are indexed by, there's my guy, AP of F. So they're indexed by primes P. Well, oh, yeah, sequences. Well, for each constituent F in the space Sk of N, I have to specify the Hecke eigenvalue AP for the primes P. Okay, so these AP of F, how do you output those? Well, for each form F, there's a number field, E sub F, which you specify in the way that I just indicated. And these APs are elements of that number field. So you have to tell me the number field. So you can imagine the indexing. One for each F, a number field for each F, and for every prime, I have to spit at you an eigenvalue, so an element of that number field. In fact, an element of the ring of integers. Okay, so you usually think about algorithms as running in finite time. So for each prime, it runs in finite time, produce that eigenvalue. But of course, you can let this thing run forever. And sooner or later, Windows will crash. Okay. Or it'll run out of memory. Okay, that's the algorithm. All right, so that makes sense? I hope that's clear. Right away, I'd like to do an example for you so you can see how this works. So everyone's favorite example is F equals Q square root 5. So we'll let W be the golden ratio or 1 over the golden ratio or some polynomial in the golden ratio, depending how you think about it. So for me, the most interesting case is parallel weight 2, and I'll probably just restrict to that for much of the rest of the talk. You don't have to, but a lot of the explanations become simpler, and you get to see everything that's going on in that case. So I'll just write S2 of n instead of Sk of n because k was a vector, but you usually make that notational simplification. Okay, so now let's just compute all of the cusp forms for Q square root 5. Why not? So we get going. So I told you the field F, and I told you what the weight's going to be. It's always parallel weight 2. So now I just have to specify the ideals. Well, naturally, ordering on the ideals is by their norm. And if you start computing, well, the program terminates and says the dimension of the space is 0 for all ideals of norm less than or equal to 30. Okay, so the first time the algorithm spits out anything other than the empty set, I guess, would be when the norm is 31. So let's take A prime, so 31 splits, because it's 1 mod 5 in this field. So you take, this field happens to have class number 1, so I can tell you a generator of this ideal, 2W minus 7. All right, so let's ask for the cusp forms inside this space. Well, this guy has dimension 1, which is pretty nice. So the Hecke module is just a one-dimensional C vector space. So for every prime P, I have to tell you an element of a number field. That number field is Q. It's equal to the dimension of the space, as we all know. So I have to specify an integer. Okay, so you let the algorithm run, and there are the integers. So for each prime P, I told you I chose a generator of that prime. I also told you its norm. And there's the AP that it spits out. Okay, so you'll probably notice a couple of interesting things here. Well, what is this F really going on? Well, there's a construction which associates to F an elliptic curve over F, little f, an elliptic curve over big F. Okay, this elliptic curve will have conductor 31. And if you take these APs, this is really supposed to be the trace of Frobenius on that elliptic curve. So if you take the norm of this prime P plus 1 minus this AP, then you get the AP, A of FP. So I called it A because it's usually an abelian variety. I can do more for you in this case. I can actually write down for you the elliptic curve that it corresponds to it in this case. So this elliptic curve, so if you can recover these APs now just by counting points on this elliptic curve, or if you like, we discovered this elliptic curve and proved that it really was this one by computing the APs. So the that's an example of the output of the algorithm and sort of its utility. In general, there's lots of things that you might want to do with these guys. I've given enough talks in Montreal and other places that you probably are sick of hearing me talk about them. Some of them include construction of Galois representations. So in this case, the elliptic curve, if you take its torsion points, those will construct interesting field extensions of F. And you can get at those field extensions without having to work directly with the elliptic curve. You can read that off of the trace of Frobenius modulo primes if you reduce the Galois representation associated with this guy. The APs uniquely specify the L function. So if you're interested in doing numerical computations with L functions, which I definitely am not, but other people are, it's all you need to do is to specify these APs. So for example, you even get information like the AP at this prime, where it coincides with the level, the AP is minus 1, corresponding to non-split reduction. So you get information like that. Okay, any questions about that? Or about this elliptic curve? Yeah. Well, look at how small the coefficients are. It's hard not to write down this elliptic curve, no matter what. Yeah, it's so small. There's, yeah. Again. You mean the classical modular curve over Q? Well, you'll notice that the number of points on this elliptic curve is different depending on the prime above 11, so it couldn't be a base change. Yeah, and its conductor is not stable. So no gamma 0 of 11. Oh. It could be, but it turns out that this elliptic curve is not a base change. So if you, and it's not. Those are good questions. Yeah, it's hard not to see that, but I don't. Yes, there's a question in the back. Ordinary. Doesn't that just have to do with if the pth Hecke eigenvalue is divisible by p or not? Is it p unit? Because yes, you can tell. So in this case, even if you reduce it mod 31, it's ordinary. So I think the answer is yes. Yeah. That's exactly right. Somehow you can understand, some extent, you know everything from the Galois representation. From its characterization is given by the trace of Frobenius and the determinant condition. So that's, and then you can read that off of these APs. So that should tell you everything you need to know. Okay. Any other questions? I hope that you'll interrupt me, even if something's just nagging at the back of your mind. Okay, well, to keep things lively, I'd like to do a live demo for you, too. So there's nothing like making an afternoon talk by having the computer crash on me. At least you'll laugh. Okay, so how does it look? So can you read that all right? I tried to make the font bigger. So how do you actually specify this as in a magma session? And how would you compute these things? Well, first of all, you have to get your copy of Magma, and it has to be the most up-to-date version of Magma. So those are personal problems, some of which I can help you with. If you don't like that, Steve Donnelly and I are just computing massive tables of Hecke eigenvalues. So much so that we feel like we'll compute all examples that anyone will ever be interested in. We're computing fields up to degree 7 of conductor until the computer starts to crash. I mean, we sort of push boundaries in all directions until, and we have access to clusters in both Sydney and the University of Vermont that allow us to do lots of things. And we're putting them into a database of L function, which I think is called L-function.org, or maybe it's modform.org. It's still under development. That's an FRG of William Stein. So pretty soon, if you just say, hey, I think there's something on Q squared 17 of this sort of level, you should be able to go to a database and look it up. So you don't even need to have Magma. Okay? But if you do have access to Magma in the meantime, or you want to do something more serious with it, these are the kinds of instructions that you would enter. Okay, so first we have to tell it the number field. So let's do that. So you have to specify the minimal polynomial. So what's the minimal polynomial of the element that I specified? I think this one's right. Okay, so there we go. So that's F. Pretty good. So let's write down the ring of integers. It'll do that for us. You just say integers F. Maximal equation order with defining polynomials. You've got to love computers. Okay, well, that's what it is. All right, so now we need to write down cusp forms. So let's do the ones of level 31. So how do you write down, we have to write down a prime of norm 31. Well, I guess I told you what it was, right? It was 2w minus 7 or something. So let's say the prime above 31 is 2 times w minus 7 times vf. And then we can really check that it's the right, has the right norm. Okay, good. Can you still read that all right? Okay, so now let's write down the space of cusp forms. So it's a pretty easy command. You do S is Hilbert cusp forms, F and the prime above 31. So if you don't tell it the weight, it assumes parallel weight 2. Okay, so it actually didn't compute anything. It just wrote down the space. But you can read a few things about it. It tells you the number field, the level, and that it verifies indeed that the weight is parallel weight 2. Okay, so what should we do with the space? Well, the first thing, the major command that you would do is called new form decomposition. So that sort of bottles together setting up all of the infrastructure, which I haven't explained to you at all yet about what actually the algorithms are doing. That's all underneath the hood for now. But this, oh, okay, sure. Let's ask for the dimension. That's a good thing to do. So it actually has to compute something now. Oh, good. It didn't take forever. What? S didn't compute anything. It just set up a space. But obviously, it's not. If you write down a space, you don't want to compute everything possible, imaginable that it might deduce from that space. That would be bad programming practice. Yeah, and in fact, it won't even set up the space when it computes the dimension. It'll use a formula for the dimension in terms of class numbers of imaginary quadratic extensions, the mass formula. So now we actually have to compute the space. Okay, so that's where you would do something like new form decomposition of S. But it's going to give me an error because S is not it's not the new subspace, it's the full space. And so there's a lot of infrastructure developed to pick off old subspaces because as far as we're concerned, well, if a form came from an old subspace, then you should deal with it on where the level, where it belongs, not in the possibly bigger space. So you just do new subspace, so let's call it S new. S new is the new subspace of S. Right now we can do new form decomposition of S new. Okay, so now it's really doing something. But it wasn't so bad just because it was a one-dimensional space. So what did it return? It returned this array of one element. Okay, because the space, this one-dimensional space, broke up into a one-dimensional irreducible component and nothing else. All right, so now it's called a cuspidal new form space, which is different than this cuspidal space because it has a new form. And now it tells you indeed the dimension is one. So let's pick out a constituent eigenform in that one-dimensional space, which is, of course, uniquely defined up to a scalar, non-zero scalar. So you do F is eigenform. So the command in Magma to do the thing in the previous line is $sign.1. So that'll do that guy. So you believe me, it's really the same thing. Now it's a representative element. Okay, so now we can ask for the Hecke eigenvalues. So we'll do something like, let's just do the norm of the prime and the Hecke eigenvalue of F at P. I'm just going to build a little table. So P in, how many primes do you want to see? Maybe 30 is enough. Okay, so those are the Heka eigenvalues. Ta-da! Okay, so I hope that everything almost fit onto one screen if we didn't have the other questions or comments. But that's really how, so I hope this tool will be useful to you in your future endeavors if Hilbert modular forms enter your life. I could think of some examples, like if you write down Q expansions of Hilbert cusp forms, this will work in any weight, in fact. And you could use things like this to compute the canonical ring, we've seen a lot of lectures on models of Hilbert modular varieties. So this would be one way that you could actually compute in any given example. You specify level, maybe level one for an interesting field. Just write down the Q expansions and write down all the multiplicative relations when you multiply out the power series. That'll give you the canonical embedding. So now the question in terms of making that into an algorithm is the degree to which you have to go, the highest weight, and how do you know you have all the relations and that sort of thing. But there's lots of tools, and so I hope this will be useful to you, and I'm so glad it didn't crash. Okay, great. There's one other thing that a question, yes? It does pretty well. I mean, yes, I did choose a baby example to minimize the possibility that things will go wrong. But we routinely will have 10-dimensional Heka constituents. So there, just writing down the number field and doing arithmetic in that field can be quite expensive. But okay, you have to wait minutes instead of fractions of seconds. But you can go get a cup of coffee or something and come back. Up to a given degree, and degree in the relations, yeah. That's what I could give you in finite amount of time. But you would have to tell me the bound on the degree and the degree of the relations that you want me to compute. Does that make sense? So that was what I was asking you before about ample versus very ample. Okay, there was another question that came up that I wanted to show you, another example, just so you believe me that there are things that aren't just elliptic curves. And this is also something that was inspired by a talk we heard earlier this year in the QVMTS on inner twists. So also, if you don't believe me, the only field is Q adjoint square root 5, which I should also mention, William Stein has a specific implementation in SAGE using the definite method, which I'll explain later, for Q adjoint square root 5, which is like 100 times faster than what we do here. So you really have to wait thousands of a second or something to get this example. But it's not general. I mean, he's really using the very specific things about Q square root 5 to go all the way in this one direction. Ours is in this direction where you get any field that you want. But, I mean, maybe you have those could answer different questions. So it's really a good world that we have both of them. So, for example, he can't do this example, and we can't. So you have Q adjoint square root 15, and you take this ideal above 5. So there's a cusp form of dimension 8 in S2 of n, such that no single Heka eigenvalue generates the entire field of Heka eigenvalues, which is one of those things you just don't believe it at first. And we discovered this because it crashed our program because we assumed that there was a primitive element that you could just take as, you know, T2 or something. All right, maybe it's not T2, you take T3, but that's false. Okay, so here's the field, which I spent some time formatting. This is also, by the way, not in the press release of the talk. So this came up in a conversation. I just wanted to show you that. So I'm sorry if this is new. But I did this over lunch. So this is the field. E is the field of Heka eigenvalues. This is the Galois closure. And U is some element in Q adjoint square root 17. Okay, so what's the relationship between this Heka field and S? Well, they're linearly disjoint. And in general, that's what happens. So the Heka field has nothing to do with the base field. Okay, so you just have some field, but there was some conversation earlier about how the Heka eigenvalues always live in a totally real field, and that's not the case. So I belongs to the Heka eigenvalue field. So whatever was happening with the self-adjoint operator, something is not true. And I don't know what it is, and, well, we can work that out on another time. But the class number is also not 1, and so maybe something like that is happening. But that, all right. I just wanted to complain. So this is really an example. I'll show you the Heka eigenvalues. There's an I there. Which is a little bit weird. So what happens is the Heka eigenvalues always live in one of these three fields, or sometimes a subfield. So they generate this bigger field, but no individual Heka eigenvalue generates. Okay, so what does this have to do? Well, it has to do with a relation to inner twists, and there's a lot of work of Ku and Stein and Murdy and others that exactly analyze this kind of problem, if you guys remember that QVMTS talk. Okay, cool. So I've used up, almost half my time, and I'm on slide 3. Okay, good. So I have to. What's the outline of the talk? Well, at least even if I don't get to the end, you've now seen what the algorithm is and how to use it and some examples. So that's I'm probably already ahead. What I'd like to do for the rest of the talk now is to sort of do a little bit of a link with what the rest of everyone has done with the geometry and tell you how you turn that into something computational. And then I'll give you kind of an overview of the method in one slide, and then I'll say as much as I can in dirty details with some examples. So in order to do that, I have to develop some quaternionic Chamorro varieties, which are like twists of Hilbert modular varieties in the sense that the quaternion algebra is a twist of GL2. So I have to redo much of what has been done, replacing GL2 by a quaternion algebra and working in a more general setting. But I hope that'll be pleasant because you already see a very simple instance of it. Okay, so I'm going to assume that, I guess I'll move over here now. I'll assume that we'll work in parallel way two. Like I said, there's no loss of generality. Things work, and you just have to replace coefficient modules, and I don't think that helps you understand what's going on. So how do you compute the classical space? I mean, in particular, you can run my algorithms with F equals Q, so we can't have been discovering anything that wasn't already there. It was just how do you make it work in the general number field case, totally real field case. Well, what do you do if you want to compute classical cusp forms? Well, what you usually do is you take the modular curve x0 of n, so you take the subgroup of upper triangular matrices, modulo n, and have it act on the completed upper half plane, and that's the modular curve. It can be given the structure of a non-singular Riemann surface. So how do you find these cusp forms? Well, you take f, and you consider f of z dz, or it's probably better to take 2 pi I f of z dz, and that's a holomorphic differential one form on the curve. Okay, and so by the theorem of Eichler-Shimura, which is just the integration pairing, tells you that it arrives naturally in the space H1, X0 of N, C. Okay, so that's the first input. This is still not any more computationally effective, but at least it's in cohomology, which is actually better to compute with. So in a similar way, a Hilbert cusp form gives rise to a holomorphic differential N form. The same calculation shows that you get a differential. This time it's an n form because it's in n variables. And now it's on the Hilbert modular variety, which I guess I'm going to not define precisely because we've seen a number of the desingularization of the quotient of the completion, etc. Okay, but the problem here is now x0 of n has dimension n as a complex variety, and it arises in hn because it's a differential n form. Okay, so yikes. So that's bad for two reasons. Bad because it's a higher degree cohomology group, and bad because it's an n-dimensional variety. Okay, and there's lots of things that make that scary. So it's just not an easy computational task. So if that really were my task, I think I would be sunk. So the only time when this does, maybe you could do something for quadratic fields and work in an H2, and well, there's reasons to believe you might be able to get something out of it, but I want to dodge this and work with complex varieties whose dimension is as small as possible. Okay, so the key idea is to use Langlands functoriality, which says that S2 of n is a Hecke module. If all you care about is the Hecke eigenvalues and not what space those Hecke eigenvalues come from, well, this should show up in lots of other quote-unquote modular varieties. You don't have to work only with the Hilbert modular variety. So in this case, Langlands functoriality is a theorem. It's the Jacquet-Langlands correspondence. And this allows us to work with the varieties of complex dimension 0 or 1. Okay, so a complex variety of dimension 0 is a set of points, and dimension 1 is a curve. Okay, so now I'm back in business again. Those are things that I can hope to have get my hands on. And what do you do? Well, you do what I said. You consider twisted forms of GL2, which are quaternion algebras, over the field F. So here we go. Let B be a quaternion algebra over F of discriminant D, and let N be coprime to D. So the level n here, in this moment I'll take an Eichler order or something, so I have to separate those two quantities. So the Jacquet-Langlands correspondence is, it's not an isomorphism. I guess I was going to put new subspaces there, but I didn't. So this is only an injection from, well, something to the space that I'm interested in. So what's this something? This is the space of quaternionic cusp forms from B of level n and parallel weight 2. Okay, I haven't told you what this S2B of n is, but you have to imagine there's some other Hecke module realization of the thing that I want. And it's an isomorphism if you restrict here to those forms which are new at the primes dividing the discriminant. The discriminant is a square-free product of primes, and that exactly uniquely characterizes the image. So it would be an isomorphism if you restrict it there, but in general you have a map. Okay, So instead of always working with a more general complex variety, I can work with any of these twisted forms, because if all I care about is the new subspace, it has lots and lots of quaternionic realizations. Okay, so Jacques A. Langlands gives us that. All right, so as you well know, if you have a quaternion algebra, there's a quadratic reciprocity says that the number of places where that algebra is ramified is finite and of even cardinality. So there's always an even-odd situation, and you can almost predict that there's a quaternionic element to a theorem where you have a separation of things into biparity. So in this case, the degree of the field comes into play. So if the degree of the field is even, well, how do you do this? Well, you could take a quaternion algebra then, which is ramified at all of the real places of the field, okay, and maybe some other ones if you wanted to have non-trivial discriminant. Okay, that's possible exactly because of class field theory, what I just said. So there exists a quaternion algebra, and that really doesn't need the field to be even. And if you do that, then it'll turn out that the dimension of the associated quaternionic Chamorro variety is dimension zero. And as a consequence of that, you get an explicit action on something, the free module generated by the ideal classes of an Eichler order of level n inside there. So I'll say some more words about that. But roughly speaking, that's a very good situation to be in. The quaternion algebra is definite, so all you're doing is looking at positive definite lattices. So that's very computationally effective. If the degree is odd, then instead you do something similar to what you do with modular curves. So now you have something, a complex variety of dimension one, and you compute it again using Eichler-Shimura. So there, and an identification of that H1 of the curve with an H1 of the associated group. So now you take this quaternionic space and you identify it with something in cohomology. So this gamma zero B of N, so I use that notation. You're supposed to think gamma zero of N, but now it's a fractor N, and there's a B because there's a quaternion algebra around, but it's defined in the same way. What do? You take this Eichler order of level N, so that's things that are upper triangular inside a maximal order. You take the things of reduced norm 1, modulo plus or minus 1, and you map it, and so that injects into PSL2R by the unique split real place of the quaternion algebra. So you take a quaternion algebra ramified at all but one real place. And, well, you have to take a plus here, because otherwise you get a copy of the cusp forms and its complex conjugate. Okay, so that was in one slide how the algorithm works. Holy cow. So what is that poor algorithm? What was it doing while you were complaining that it took a minute to work? Well, it has to set up all this data. It has to write down a quaternion algebra that will work. It has to compute a maximal order and then an Eichler order. Then for that guy, it has to, well, in the naive case, compute the ideal classes for that order and then start going to town on those ideal classes by computing the action of the Heck operators, which was explained in a couple of ways already today by the action of lattices and sublattices and identifying find those guys. I'll say a little bit more about it as well. And what do you have to do here? And that was only if the Chamorro variety is dimension zero. If it's dimension one, we have to write down the Chamorro curve in some way, meaning you have to give an explicit presentation for this group and then somehow write down H1 gamma zero N of C as a Hecke module. It's easy to do as a C vector space because the action of this group on C is trivial. So this is just group cohomology just becomes homomorphisms from a group into C, and then you have an explicit action there. So writing it down, those are the sorts of things that it's doing under the hood. So you're sort of glad that you don't get your hands grimy by digging around too far. Okay. So I guess, all right, so how am I doing? What I owe you now is an explanation of what the space of quaternionic forms is, but that's sort of like a 10,000-foot overview of what happens. So you look at twisted forms by considering quaternion algebras instead, which gives you a different Hecke module realization, which may make it seem more complicated, but in fact it's much more amenable to computation. Okay, so let's talk quaternion algebra some more. All right, so what's a quaternion modular form? Well, I guess some of you were in my class at McGill last semester. Those of you who weren't, maybe were in Jace's class or have heard us talk enough about this stuff that you're used to it. So, the wiki explanation of a quaternionic modular form is their analytic function on the dels of B, which with a certain left and right invariance. If someone held a gun to you and said, tell me what it is in one sentence, that's basically what they are. So they're really not bad. They're just functions on the group with the dels of the group with a certain invariance. So we have to unpack that. How does this have anything to do with functions on the upper half plane? So I'm going to spend maybe 10 minutes doing that. Bye. Sorry, I don't know why. This is the problem for using my own pointer. Okay, sorry about that. I guess it got stuck. It's telling me to speed up the states are. Okay, so I have to set up notation, which is going to be among all the possible speakers, coincident with some of them, but not all of them. And my notation is superior, so that's why I'm introducing new ones. Okay, so you take and index the real places in some by some choice. Well, you could even do that canonically by taking the roots of a primitive generator and ordering those. So that there's usually a natural way to do that. And let's suppose that, well, the quaternion algebra B that you wrote down of discriminant D, I'm allowing you to pick anyone that you like. And for now, I'm going to allow you to be split and it's split and ramified at the real places, and I just want you to index them accordingly. So let's put all of the split ones in the first R and the ramified ones and the ones that remain. Okay, so now it would be nice if we could just take R to be 0 or 1, but maybe you'll want to take R is equal to N, then we'll get as examples the Hilbert modular varieties, and you can sort of see everything in between. That provides some uniform way of describing all these guys. So for each, so what does it mean to be ramified and split? Well, if you take B and you tensor it up to the reals from the rationals, you get some number of copies of the matrix ring, some number of copies of the Hamiltonians. And I just want you to order them in that way. Okay, nothing interesting yet. So now I'm going to introduce this K-infinity, which is also was already in Eyal's talk this morning. He even called it K-infinity. And it's just the stabilizer. So you want to identify B infinity with something that looks like the upper half plane or copies of the upper half plane. Here we'd have R of them. And what you do is you take the stabilizer of the square root of minus 1 in the upper half plane. I'm reserving my I as an index if I need it. And what's that stabilizer? Well, it's the orthogonal group, those rotations. Scalar matrices act by the identity. And you take the whole H cross and the other factors because I'm only taking R in those first factors. So that's the full stabilizer. And that's my maximal compact that I'll take as my real point. That's why you begin to see already the upper half plane. It comes to the stabilizer of a particular choice there. Okay, so now I have to choose some other notation to let O0 of 1 be a maximal order inside B. We'll take an Eichler order. I've already said those are the things which are upper triangulo modulo N after a choice of splitting of the quaternion algebra at the primes dividing N. That's why I needed to have N to be coprime to the discriminant. That exactly allows me to produce an Eichler order at this given level. And rather than using a Delek notation, I like putting hats on things, so chapeaus. And here, so we'll let V hat be this restricted direct product of VPs. And whenever I put a hat on something, that's going to be the finite Adelic version of that thing. So that way, if it's an Adel or an Adelic object, I'll put a hat on it. So you can remember where that's coming from. Okay, I hope that's all the notation for now. So now I can tell you what a quaternionic modular form is, okay, so now when you click on the wiki link, it now gives you an expanded definition. It says they're analytic functions on B infinity cross together with B hat cross. Remember, that's really the edels of B. And we want them to be invariant on the left by the action of multiplication by B cross and transform on the right by this compact subgroup K infinity and the edelic points of O in a specified way. Okay, so I'll break it down for you. So now here's the definition, a quaternionic modular form. Again, I'm doing parallel way two because a few things become invisible now, which makes it easier to digest. So this is an analytic function. Like I said, here's the domain. If you like, these really are the Adelic points of B. I've just split out the finite and the infinite parts because they always have to be treated differently. But you could make that identification if you want. Here the image is just the complex numbers. In higher way, you have a different module that it takes values in. And here's the invariance. Okay, so if you have any G alpha hat in this group, you have three properties. So first of all, you could multiply on the right by something in O hat cross, and I want it to be invariant under right multiplication. So that's this first statement here. O cross, I just want it to be invariant on the right by multiplication by O hat cross. So what happens if I multiply on the right by an element of K infinity, kappa? Well, I have to get some automorphy factor. That should make you happy. That's sort of like the automorphy that you would be expecting. That encodes the exact nature of the modularity of the thing. So here I get a product over the R different places because there's R upper half planes that are in existence. And so it transforms by that J automorphy factor. Okay, the last one is that I want it to be invariant under multiplication on the left by things in B cross. And that's it. Okay, so if you haven't ever, I don't think we've seen the link yet between the sort of Shimura way of thinking of Hilbert modular varieties and the more classical way of doing it, but that's really, so I'll do, I think maybe I should do that link next, just so you see the link between the two. Okay, here's notation. M2, B of N will be the space of such forms, and in case I forget, S2 will be the cusp form. All right. So if you have such a function, so modular forms are analytic functions which are invariant on the left and transform on the right. Well, such a function uniquely defines a function on the quotient, because after all, if you specified invariance by this group, well, you could pick a value in some coset here, and then all the values are uniquely specified by the fact that it has to be right invariant up to that automorphy on cap infinity. So what is this thing, after all? So now it's really the idyllic points modulo a compact thing. Well, I've already shown you how to identify this B infinity cross mod K infinity. That's really copies of not the upper half plane, but as we've all seen, union of the upper and lower half plane, because I haven't specified the positive determinant condition yet. That's just C minus R. And this is just you take an element and you map it to wherever it takes the square root of minus 1 in R places. Okay, so that's why, so if you didn't like the previous slide, you can immediately say equivalently a modular, quaternionic modular form. It's just a function on R copies of the plus and minus upper half plane, upper and lower half plane, cross, well, whatever this thing is. And so it's holomorphic in the first variable. Analytic, in this case, means locally constant in the second variable. And then this is what happens to the condition that was left over. So I still haven't said anything about B cross acting on the left. So that was the only thing after you've quotiented it out by the unique specification on the right. Okay? So this really should, I mean, if this one wasn't here, this really should look exactly like a Hilbert modular form. Well, and this thing, once we quotient out by B, is going to give us the ideal classes that we'll see in a second. Okay? I hope that was clear. So I just linked the more idyllic identification of a quaternionic modular form with something like really functions, holomorphic function on the upper half plane that transform with respect to the action of the group. Okay, so what's this guy? So I have to do one more thing, which is to get to the upper half plane rather than the upper and lower half planes. Okay, so this is pretty easy. So what happens when you take a quotient by B cross? So I'm going to let this be the x0bn of C. So these are functions are also invariant on the left by B cross. So what happens when you take the full quotient? Well, I'm going to call that x0b something. It has a name, x. All right, so what happens here? Well, if you guys remember from my quaternion class, the Eichler theorem of norms says that if you look at the reduced norms of B cross, you get F cross, but at the real places that are ramified, the thing has to be positive. After all, at a real place, it's the Hamiltonians. The norm looks like the sum of four squares, so the only things you can get are positive. Okay? That's the only condition to be a norm from the algebra. Okay? So in particular, if you look at the quotient of things which are positive, at those places, oh, I guess I should have had parentheses here between the two. These are supposed to mean the same thing versus the, oh no, I guess I want them to be positive everywhere rather than just positive at those places. What's the difference? Those differences are exactly the places where it wasn't split in the first, that it was split. So there's a Z mod 2. In other words, you could write down an element of the quaternion algebra which has a negative reduced norm at any combination of the split places. That's the Z mod 2 Z to the R that you get. And so you might as well, I mean, you want cosets with respect to this group, and these guys will switch the upper and lower half planes in each of the R components, so you might as well just restrict to the totally positive things acting on the upper half plane, because once you have a coset here, again, by the invariance, you've uniquely specified the function. Okay, so that's why, even though B might have had some weird combination of real places, at the end of the day, you're always looking at totally positive things, which is why you get a uniform strict class number rather than something else. Okay, so now you have a function on not just on the union of upper and lower half planes, but just on R copies of the upper half plane, which is an improvement. Okay, now I need to tell you about this other factor. So what is it? So if you just take this Shimura thing, remember it's a double coset, upper half plane, this, but they're invariant on the left by the global points. Well, let's just forget about the upper half plane. That's a continuous map, just a projection map, forgetting about that point. So what's left over? This B plus cross acting on the B hat and on the right by O hat. What is that guy? Well, one way that you could check to ask what it is to reply the reduced norm. So where does the image of this thing land? Well, if you take B hat cross and you take a reduced norm, you land in F hat cross. If you take reduced norms of these guys, you land in totally positive things in F cross. And here you land in VF hat cross because these things are units. Okay, this is, if you know your class field theory, naturally identified with the totally positive, well, or called the strict or narrow class group. I don't know why it's narrow. It's weaker. But I don't, never mind. So how do you get this identification? Well, if you have an ideal class here, you pick a representative ideal, and you map it to its idealization. So these are fractional ideals, which means locally principal. So you choose a generator at every component. Well, that's well-defined up to scaling that locally and by the global isomorphism, because that changes the ideal class. Okay, that's a summary of this isomorphism. The same thing actually happens here. These are right O modules of the isomorphism. Because if you have a right O module, which is locally principal, you idealize, so you choose generators. Those are well-defined up to O hat cross. The isomorphism is exactly multiplication on the left by the totally positive things. Okay, so this is now the strict class group of F. So wow, I've even really said this. The Ray class group with modules equal to the product of all infinite places of F. So you allow this, this is a group which is the Galois group of the maximal abelian extension of the field F, which is ramified only at infinite primes, if you like to consider that. So the discriminant has to be a unit. Okay, so strong approximation is the statement that this map, which is always surjective, is a bijection. And that holds if B is indefinite, but it's not true in general if B is definite. Sorry, that's a typo. I can't fix those on the fly. This really should be definite. Okay, so it's not true if B is definite. Okay, so in these methods, there's always a difference between the definite case and the indefinite case, and it boils down to the fact that either this is a bijection or it's not. And if it's not a bijection, well, you have to take that into account, and otherwise you do. Okay, so it really depends on B is definite or indefinite. So I'm going to do the indefinite case because that'll get us to Shimura curves, and that's where my heart is. So we'll assume indefinite. So what is this space x0bn of C? Well, if you bought what I said on the previous slide, I hope that you're still with me. There's a continuous projection map from here to here. This is a class group, and in particular, it's a finite set. So the projection map naturally identifies this thing as a disjoint union of connected Riemannian manifolds that can be given that structure of dimension R, and they're indexed naturally by the strict class group. Okay. So let's choose representatives for this class group. And we're going to need idyllic representatives for this. So let's choose some idyllic representative. Now you can see the virtue of my hat notations, because it helps you to remember that, such that when you take this and you intersect it with ZF, you get this ideal. It's always possible because, by definition, they're locally principal. And just in case you were trying to do something gnarly to me, for the trivial class, choose it to be the ring of integers and choose 1. All right, otherwise, my notation is going to go bad. Okay, the strong approximation says that the map is surjective. There's always an element of B hat cross which maps to this element that I chose. And that's the surjectivity of the map. In fact, the bijection is a full statement of strong approximation. Okay, so I'm going to have to introduce a new order now, and this order is the thing that I get when I conjugate my original order, when I make it idyllic, and I intersect with B so that I actually get global elements instead of idyllic elements. Where does this show up? Well, you'll see in the decomposition. Well, you've already seen it 3 times, I think, where everyone slips through to the next slide so you don't read it very closely. And I'll probably do the same thing to you. But it's the GJ intersect GJ conjugation. That's where this is showing up here. Okay. And I'm going to require this O1, the ideal generated by 1, to be O. And this gamma 0 of A is just the same thing when I take the totally positive units and I intersect it with the idyllic elements inside A. So those are like, so you have this group and you can conjugate it idyllically, and then you see what its mirror images are in the real group, up to choices of ideal classes, which would give you isomorphisms of orders downstairs. These describe all of the possible groups. And these gamma of A are exactly the things that you need to describe the Shimura variety. So the Shimura guy, which is, if you think of a bunch of Riemannian R manifolds, so this is, as a set, what they are. That's the statement of strong approximation. I just picked representatives, so now I get all these classes. And if I just map this guy to this guy, so I have a quotient of the upper half plane by now, an honest group, a subgroup of a quaternion group acting by linear fractional transformations on the upper half plane. And this identification is just, well, if I take this coset, and I happen to have the alpha hat here, then I map it to Z. So otherwise, I might have something weird here, but then I take the element which identifies this one with this, and I map it to that element gamma Z. But that's a very natural identification between those spaces. Okay, so that, I think, completes the link. I hope, if you haven't seen it before, or if you have seen it, that this was sensible to go from a rather general Shimura-like definition of what a modular form is, and you really see what it looks like. So in this case, as I said, it's a space of dimension of manifolds of dimension R indexed by the class group. If we take R is equal to 1, I told you that was going to be my favorite case. Now they're manifolds of dimension 1. Those are Riemann surfaces. And this space is now happily just a disjoint union of Riemann surfaces indexed by the class group. So it's a bunch of curves. Isn't that nice? Okay, so I'm telling you that the modular forms that I wanted to compute, I could also see on this disjoint union of curves, which is pretty grand. Just to summarize everything that I said up till now, in the case R is equal to 1, a modular form of parallel way 2, a quaternionic modular form, and level n on B, what is it? It's a tuple of functions indexed by the strict class group, just from the upper half plane to C, indexed by the class group, such that for every one of these chosen representatives, you have this very nice usual, I just boiled down the definition where R is equal to 1 and there's a various condition for all A, B, C, D, and gamma of A, and all Z and H. Okay, so that is actually, you could have taken that to be the definition and avoided all the previous slides. And in fact, maybe now that I've said it to you once, I won't ever tell you again, and I'll just start here in the next talks. But, okay? Any questions about that? What's happening? So, all right. If you checked out of me for my talk, I hope you'll join me again, so tune back in. I'm going to do an example so you can see what all these things really look like when the class number isn't 1. So in case you weren't at my CRM talk a year ago, I did post the slides from that talk where I give the strict class number 1 and give a different set of details here. So you could, if you wanted to, look through those. So this is a new example for those of you who were at the CRM, so pay attention. Okay, so this is an example where the strict class number isn't 1. So you can see an actual disjoint union, and there's some funny modularity and Jacobians that pop up, which is kind of cool. Okay, so I picked the smallest example where one of these things happens. It's not Q square root 5. So we'll take level 1, which is a nice place to work. So let's take the totally real cubic field of prime discriminant 257. Of course, it's hard to fault choosing the prime 257 being 256 plus 1. It's totally real. What else can I say? It's uniquely defined by that discriminant. Here's a minimal polynomial for a primitive generator. Okay, that's not so exciting. So in case you were wondering, F is a non-Galois extension. You could have seen that just because the discriminant is not a square. It has Galois group S3, and as it turns out, W generates the ring of integers, monogenic. So this F, as it turns out, is just barely not strict class number 1. It's class number 1, but strict class number 2. Okay, so that's almost, but that really does make a difference here. So how do you see that? Well, the difference between the class group and the strict class group is measured by this quotient, the group of totally positive units modulo squares. That's 1 if and only if the strict class group is equal to the class group, and in general, that's the extension that you get. It's a little exercise that you have to do. So this is the unique unit. I told you that there's it's a Z mod 2Z, and this is the thing which is totally positive but not a square. That's the unique such thing, totally positive units modulo squares. Okay. So now we're going to pretend that we're the algorithm, and I'm going to show you what's going on under the hood and all of those details. Okay, the first thing the poor algorithm has to do is to write down a quaternion algebra, which is ramified. So I'm going to take level 1 here. I guess I haven't told you that, but it has to be ramified at no finite place and ramified at 2 of the 3 real places so that I get a dimension 1 thing with the unique split place. So it works hard and it finds 1. I guess it doesn't have to work too hard. Maybe the naive algorithm I should implement first where you just try small linear combinations of the obvious things. But here you just take minus 1, W minus 1. So this is the usual quaternion algebra generated by elements I squared is minus 1, J squared is W minus 1, and these guys do commute. Okay, so you wanted to believe me that this is ramified or not at the real places. Well, I claim this has discriminant 1 and is ramified at 2 of the real places and unramified at the place with W going to 2.19869. So if you factor this polynomial of the reals, you'll get 3 real numbers. One of them is 2.19, so when I subtract 1, I have a positive thing. That means that it's unramified at that real place. And if you take the other real roots, I think the other two are negative. So when you take minus 1, then you get something which is a Hamiltonian. Okay, great. So now you get to see this. Now it has to write down a maximal order here. So here the maximal order you choose, this, since it has class number 1, it has a basis, which is not necessary by the way it's computing it, but here's the kinds of things that are going on under the hood, the order that you'll work with, which is maximal. Oh, just kidding. I'm going to do Eichler orders. I guess I wanted to impress you for some reason. Are you going to be impressed by this? Okay, all right, sure, let's do it. So this is in fact an Eichler order. So I took an order of square level two for fun. All right, that's good job. So this is a prime of norm three, and so I'm going to take level nine. Maybe this is too small, so in degree, in smaller level, the dimension of the space of forms is zero or something. Okay, so there you go. The first thing, of course, you're used to seeing from me are pictures. So here's a fundamental domain to the action of gamma. Remember, gamma is just the elements of that weird thing, O, of reduced norm one. Well, I guess I have to take the totally positive things there. So that's the thing that's acting on the upper half plane that are units. And then I act by linear fractional transformations. So this is the thing that you get. And I acted on the unit disk instead of the upper half plane, but I use a conformal identification. Sorry, this should be a D, not an H. I think the pictures are always prettier when you write them in the unit disk. I believe that Escher would agree based on the number of drawings that he made. So there you go. You'll notice that this is compact. It always stays some positive different distance away from the boundary. That's a general property of if you take any one of these quaternion algebras, if it's a division algebra, the corresponding thing is compact. So I'm sorry to say all of the great talks that we've heard up until now on toroidal compactifications don't apply. You can get away with never having to compactify if you're willing to take something other than GL2, you guys, right? Because the only thing that's not a division algebra over a number field is the matrix ring. Okay, so everything else is compact. So Pierre was giving me a hard time because if you look at the slides from the talk that I gave at CRN, it looks like the mirror image of this, which makes you might think that I only have one picture and I'm just rotating it or flipping it. But I promise you I worked hard to draw this picture. But they all sort of look the same. Okay, so I told you there was a strict class group acting. So there's two ideal classes that's up to strict equivalence. So there's the unit class and some class, which is principal, but not strictly principal. In other words, it is generated by something, but that something is not totally positive. Okay, so now how does this algorithm work? Well, if you remember from the previous slides, what you have to do is to consider the conjugate orders, consider their groups, because the corresponding Shimura curve is really curves. It's two of them. One of them is the one that I just showed you the picture of, and the other one is this adelic conjugate. Okay, so how do you get from one to the other? Well, the adelic thing is, so I have to write down this element, which is the reduced norm. I represent edelic things by ideals, because I can't write down an edel. I have to work somehow globally. So that is represented by this ideal. I write down an ideal of the order with that norm. That's like writing down the alpha hat, whose norm is this A hat. But I can do that computationally. That's how those things work. So the left order of this JA is exactly the adelic conjugate intersects with B. So that's an easy exercise for anyone who's in my class or even for those who haven't been. And so now you get something even worse than the order that I wrote down before, but it's still an Eichler order of the level which was W squared, I guess, of norm 9. Okay, so here's the action of gamma A on the unit disk. I promise you it's different than the other one. Do you believe me? All right, check it out. There you go. Here's the other one, a little different. Okay, so how different are these groups really? I mean, they're related, but here's the orders are not isomorphic. So you know that because the connecting ideal is not principal. Okay, so these groups, gamma and gamma A, are not conjugates as subgroups of PSL2R. Okay, so they're not isomorphic as Riemann surfaces, but they have the same signature. Okay, in this case, the signature is 1, semicolon, 2, 2, 2, 2. That means that the genus of the curve is 1, and there are 4 elliptic elements of order 2. So things that whose square is a scalar, in fact, minus 1. So if you know the theory of Fuchsian groups, this group gamma, as an abstract group, is isomorphic to gamma of A, but not conjugate as subgroups of PSL2, which is really weird. That's why they're very close to one another, but they sort of give rise to different curves. And in general, if you have a group of signature of this form, you have 2 generators for times the genus, and then you have elements representing the elliptic cycles, and they have the property, well, these guys are squares. That's exactly the elliptic cycle condition. And you take the product of commutators of the genus elements and the products of those elements, you get 1. That's a general presentation for this group. Okay, so in particular, these Shimura curves both have genus 1. I chose that for niceness. And so the dimension of this H1 of X of C, so X of C, remember, is just the union of, disjoint union of X1 and XA. So the H1 is just the direct sum of those two. So the dimensions add. So that's 4, because you have a copy of, well, it's twice the genus. You can see that also from this description. I mean, if you take the quotient of this by its abelianization, you'll see that it's generated uniquely by gamma and gamma prime. It's a free Z module generated by those guys. So in fact, that's a good thing to do. So you choose this basis of characteristic functions. I already told you this H1 is just a HOM, right? Because the action on C is trivial. So this is just homomorphisms from gamma to C, but that has been factored through the abelian quotient. That abelian quotient is just Z squared. Okay, and I'm saying choose the characteristic functions for gamma and gamma prime as the representatives of those guys. Yes, finally a question. The L function of the Shimura curve or something? I'll tell you some things you'll like on the next slide, and then ask that again in case they're not. It's not what you like. All right, so now you apply Eichler-Shimura component by component, you get this H1. So now we can find this as a Hecke module inside this by acting by the curve. So this S2 is going to be dimension 2. It cuts down by half because we got it by the curve. Okay. So Hecke operators are a black box, and I think you're glad at this point in the afternoon that I'm not going to force feed you ideal classes and all right. But it's 3 ways of understanding Hecke operators. They're averaging operators. They come from an abstract double coset composition or by summing over sublattices. All these are equivalent and good ways of understanding them that I'm not going to say anything more. Okay, so let's first act by complex conjugation so that we're not just getting a space in this complex conjugate. Let's pick out one copy. Okay, so we had a 4-dimensional space. We want to cut it down to a 2-dimensional space. Okay, so black box, you get this as the action of complex conjugation. So you better check that the square of this matrix is 1. Okay, so now you consider a Hecke operator. So there'll be a couple of them. TP, let's take P to be 2W minus 1, so that's a Hecke operator norm 7. So this represents a non-trivial class in this class group. So this is what the Hecke operator looks like acting on H. It's a block matrix exactly corresponding to the fact that this element lies over something non-trivial. So the Hecke operators are permuting the curves, and since there's only 2 of them, if you have a non-trivial class, it's just interchanging them. Okay. And of course, now that you know the quotient by complex conjugation, you take the 4-dimensional vector space, cut it down to dimension 2, and see the induced action on this guy, and then you're just going to get some 2x2 matrix. Okay, but this 2x2 matrix is pretty nice. It has trace 0 and determinant minus 16. So that means their eigenvalues plus or minus 4. So this, as a Hecke module, decomposes into 2 Hecke irreducible spaces of dimension 1, and the T7 is 4 and minus 4 in that space. Okay, if you do something which is principal, well, then it won't be skew block. It'll just be honestly block. And in fact, I didn't even write down the matrix for you because it's just 3. It acts by the matrix 3, by some miracle of smallness of choices of things. Okay, so that means it's going to act as the scalar 3 on the quotient. Okay, so then you boil it down and you compute a bunch of eigenvalues. Okay, so in fact, this is what the algorithm was doing all the time. Okay, so what do you notice about those guys? So there's 2 forms representing the 2 irreducible components, F and G. I mean, it's painful not to say, oh my gosh, they're the same up to plus or minus, right? So what does that mean about F and G? You guys are not used to having questions lobbied at you. That's okay. Snacks are coming. G is the quadratic twist of F by something, and if you just examine the signs exactly match up by the strict class group. So there's a character of conductor 1 corresponding exactly to the strict. So remember F plus over F, F plus is the strict class group, as degree 2 over F, it's something. So if you look at the quadratic character associated to that and you twist F by that character, it still has level that it started, the same level, and you get G. It just changes the sign, chi of AP. All right. So you also notice that these forms don't arise as something from the base change from Q. Why is that? Well, that's because if you look at the primes above 61, if it was a base change, then the elliptic curves corresponding to F and G would just be the base change from Q up to those guys. So if you reduce that modulo 61, it doesn't matter what prime above 61 you had, they would have to have the same number of points over that finite field, but they don't. Okay, so these are some elliptic curves, well, they're genus 1 curves. All right, since APS three different values for the points of 961. Okay, sorry, that's the last that you'll see of the eigenvalues, but after a while they just look like numbers, I guess. But these are, all right, so what's going on here? What's the corresponding Shimura curves, and what do they have to do with F and G? Okay, well, first of all, I should try to find them. So we search for elliptic curves of this conductor, and we find two of them. How do you do that? Well, you have to work hard, so you search for them, and there are methods. Yeah. Yep, I'm going to say that next. Don't steal my thunder. But you're exactly, okay, good. I'm glad you like this. Okay. Okay, so what are these two things supposed to be? Well, I mean, are they the Shimura curves? Well, I'm going to have two Shimura curves, and then I compute modular forms on them, and I somehow get elliptic curves. What do they have to do with each other? Well, okay, by the way, you can prove that these are actually modular elliptic curves over F by a trick due to Skinner and Wiles that says that if they have non-trivial 2-torsion and there's some condition on the 3-torsion, then they're modular by proving that they're 2-adic or 3-adic, etc. So you really do match Hecke eigenvalues, and you see that they have the same number of points as the, you know, as I did on like the second slide. So n norm of p plus 1 minus ap. Okay, so now let's get to Henri's points. So what can you tell me about these curves x1 and xa? All right. Well, by Deligne's theory of canonical models, we know that this guy has a model over F. But that's one of those lame things where, well, these are not individually defined over F, only their union, which means that the Galois group, in fact, they're defined not over F, but they're defined individually over the strict class field, and they're interchanged by the action of Galois. Okay, so these elliptic curves can't be these guys, because these are defined over F plus, and these are defined over F. So you see there's just W's. I haven't had to tell you what F plus is. So what on earth do they have to do with each other? Well, these Hecke eigenvalues only ever tell you things up to isogeny. Right? They're counting points, and counting points is invariant under isogeny in finite fields. So what really happens is you take the Jacobian of this thing. In case you haven't ever taken the Jacobian of a disjoint union of curves, it's pretty fun. It's just the product of the Jacobians of the components. Okay, that thing is now an abelian surface. Up to isogeny, it's the product of these two. Okay, but you do those isogenies over F plus if you like. And that's how you get the corresponding Galois representation. Okay, so that provides a link and a little bit of a mystery why, although you have these components, you always have an interesting Galois action, and why up to isogeny you're actually constructing things over F, not over F plus. Okay, pretty cool, huh? So every example like this, these are really what the curves look like, and well, as close as I can at this point to showing you equations. I can show you equations for an isogeny image or of something isogenous to the Jacobian of the thing. Okay, that's not so bad. All right, I'm so not telling you anything more about definite things because I'm over time, so I'll end here. Thanks very much.